Hello and welcome to episode 58 of Popcorn Optional, a weekly movie podcast where we talk all things movies, and this week we're reviewing Sicario: Day of the Soldado, or as I like to call it, Sicario. Why Emily Blunt and Denis Villeneuve are awesome. But first, we have some news and trailers to get to, a new segment we're calling MovieCast Mad Libs, and as always, we will end the episode with our content of the week. My name is Cameron Slanina, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host Jake Brown and Trevor Allison.
Hello.
Yep, back again.
The whole crew is back after me unfortunately missing out on last week, where I gotta be honest, I have very differing opinions on you guys from Jurassic World. There's some, I won't recap everything, but I think I liked it. I liked it, but there's also a bunch of things I didn't like. There's a lot of illogical things that you guys hit on that I completely agree with, but
after more time to reflect, I wish I had been a little bit nicer to it, but I don't feel any differently about it.
I stand by everything I said.
I'll say, like, the first half of the movie is like the second best Jurassic Park movie.
Yeah. Oh my.
No? The first half of the movie? No? That Mosasaurus scene at the beginning is intense. Really? Jake, what's a better Jurassic Park movie? Because I know you're not going to say Jurassic World, so between 2 and 3.
I think the third one is more interesting than the second one.
You mean the one where a Velociraptor talks to Alan Grant in the in the airplane?
In his dream.
In his dream.
Okay. It was a dream.
It was a dream. I will say the funniest thing I saw regarding this movie was, so at the end of the first half, there's that Brontosaurus on the dock, and like it gets killed by the lava. And somebody tweeted out, in case everybody was freaking out about that Brontosaurus dying, it was an alcoholic and abusive dad, so don't worry. I thought that was
dang,
pretty spot on. Pretty funny.
That was the most emotional moment of the movie, which is a problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're probably fine not going to see this movie, folks, let's be honest. But let's go ahead and get into news and trailers for other movies that you shouldn't go see, such as Jared Leto playing Morbius, the vampire, in a spin-off film of his own for Sony, which I think is given credence by the fact that the Venom trailer has been viewed more than any other Spider-Man trailer in the history of Spider-Man trailers.
Okay,
which blows my
mind. That's got to be because of the Venom tongue jokes, right?
You think
people
do you guys, like, how does views work on YouTube? Like, is there a certain amount of time that you have to watch for in order for it to count as a view? Or if somebody replays that same scene at the end over and over again, does that count as a view?
I'm guessing it's tied to page visits.
No, a YouTube view is about 30 seconds.
Okay.
Oh.
Whereas a Facebook view is around 3 seconds. That's what the top result on Google is telling me. So take that as you will.
Okay, so anyone excited for Jared Leto as Morbius the vampire movie?
So I would be interested in this if it were, you know, within the realms of a franchise that had been successful. I think that this is right up his alley.
It's right up his wheel.
It's right up his wheel. You're right.
It's right up in that wheel.
I don't know that I like. I respect Sony trying to rebuild their Spider-Man franchise by starting with spinoffs. I respect the method because no one's ever tried it before.
They're just doubling down on this, like, anti-hero thing. Like, it's almost like, hey, you know, Deadpool worked.
It's like,
let's double down on the R-rated superhero.
Basically, what's happening here is that what Netflix did with their, like, third-tier, interesting, small-scale superheroes, Marvel made nice little Netflix series with their third-tier, small-scale heroes, and instead, Sony's making entire giant-budget movies.
Yeah. Would you be excited about this movie if it wasn't Jared Leto as Morbius?
No. I mean,
doesn't matter for me.
Anything that Sony does with Spider-Man, in my opinion, is just like hard pass.
Yeah.
Except for Into the Spider-Verse.
Yeah, that's true.
But that's also Lord and Miller, so that doesn't really count.
It'll probably get scrapped anyways, so they'll get kicked off the project, they'll get replaced, it's not a big deal.
You know, the movie's in the can, but we're going to fire Lord and Miller as the writers on the film and producers.
What if that becomes, like, their thing? Like, they come in and, like, start a project, and then they bring in a different director to finish it.
Gosh, that'd be the worst.
Yeah, that would be really
so
weird.
Sad for them. That'd be like...
Wait, we need to do some research. Has it ever happened... Is there a director that's been fired in the middle of production twice?
Probably.
Oh, I don't know. Does Bryan Singer? I feel like Bryan Singer was just fired from the Bohemian Rhapsody.
Was
film.
He on that?
He's the director.
Oh.
Yes. He was fired with a little bit left, and he won't be doing the final bit of the film or the reshoots. And then for some reason, I feel like he was fired from Jack the Giant Slayer, that Jack and the Beanstalk movie with Nicholas Hoult.
Okay. I mean, he seems like the kind of person that would be fired twice from a movie.
It's so weird, like, how many... Like, if you make one movie that's pretty good, it gives you, like... It feels like today that gives you, like, five movies of grace, period.
Right. Unless you're Josh Trank.
Yeah, but he's the worst, so...
Yes.
It doesn't really count.
Yeah, it's the M. Night Shyamalan thing of, like, you make one good movie, you get a handful of bad ones.
Yeah.
To buy back into the good graces.
Well, even now people are he did make Signs, or he did make Sixth Sense. It's like, he made Avatar The Last Airbender.
Signs is the only, like, actual movie he made. The rest of them are just twists that are too long.
True.
Yeah, I agree. All right, let's get into a couple trailers here, the first of which being The House with the Clock in Its Walls, starring Jack Black and Kate Blanchett, and what looks to be like a crossover of Ghostbusters and The Haunted Mansion. So what did you guys think about this? Because I think this is our first full-length teaser or full-length trailer that we've gotten for this. What did you guys think?
I know I've talked a lot, but I have to say this. Jack Black, his acting performance in this is like it's an SNL skit.
He's literally...
Half the time were you just waiting for him to rid it?
This looks abismal.
He's just like...
Oh, gosh.
I'm a warlock. Do you want to be a warlock? There's a clock in the wall.
We don't know why it's there, but it's dangerous and we're not moving out.
We've lived here the whole time. It's fine.
Kate Blanchett's in this, so I'm going to give that some credit. The other thing I will say is that Ghostbusters look like garbage, and I had some fun watching that movie. Or not Ghostbusters. Goosebumps.
Yeah, Goosebumps was surprisingly... great.
So I look at this in the same bump as like that Goosebumps type film, and so if this can capture some of that magic, great. But if this goes the Book of Henry route with kid with goggles syndrome again, I'm out.
Kids with goggles syndrome.
Fully out on kids with goggles.
Anything with kids with goggles. Phantom Menace, Book of Henry, I'm out. I don't want it.
It's a safe bet.
Next up is a film that will probably be nominated for many Oscars or will be regarded as a trash film, depending on how good it is. We don't know. It's just kind of early on. But it's a trailer for a movie called Beautiful Boy with Timothy Chalamet and Steve Carell. Did this tug at your guy's heartstrings?
Oh, yeah. This looks like your typical... indie Oscar nominated character study film that addresses a hot topic in society at the moment with some incredible performances. Steve Carell and Timothy Chalamet. Did I say that right?
I think so.
Okay. Yeah. They are both. I mean, Steve Carell, I think, is one of the best actors of his generation. He was the first person that I nominated to be an honorable mention for a reason. I think he can do very little wrong. And, Timothée Chalamet is proving to be the same. He is a force of nature. And so I'm really excited about this one.
Guys, I'm really concerned that if Timothée Chalamet is not in something less serious, he's going to quit acting soon.
He needs something fun.
I want to see him in something funny.
He really needs to pick a movie and just like take it easy or something. It's
Yeah.
No, I'm
like,
I mean,
put
I
him
joke,
in
but,
the new Men in Black movie.
Right? Yeah, there we go. Exactly. He can be the even younger K.
Yes. So he's the young Josh Brolin to the young Tommy Lee Jones. Brilliant.
Brilliant.
Yeah, incredibly emotional trailer. It's one of those movies that you kind of watch and you're like, well, they're obviously going for the Oscar, but it doesn't seem Oscar baity. Like, it's not like The King's Speech where you're like, wow, okay, they're really pushing. It's kind of like there's a lot of personal aspects to this movie that will probably, at least from the looks of it, be pretty well done just based on that opening diner scene in the trailer. Lastly is a trailer for the Predator movie directed by Shane Black, which is a reboot, legacy sequel, however you want to call it, for the Predator franchise. We talked about this earlier when there was the teaser trailer for Predator released, but now that there's a full-length trailer, does this have you guys any more interested in this movie?
Negative.
Negative. Cool.
Oh, see, to me, it just looks, it looks like the best kind of bad.
Like that B-movie type film?
Yeah, like, let's just go all out ridiculous on this thing. And Shane Black can definitely do ridiculous.
I will say, like, this doesn't, it looks, I agree with Trevor. Like, it looks like good bad. Like, bad movie making done well. Or, like, bad script done well. But then it was, like, the point in the trailer was, like, oh, man, this is the mega Predator. We're out of ideas. Yeah. Let's make a bigger one. I was just like, ugh. Come on, really? That's the best idea we had? A bigger one?
That felt very like John Connor being a Terminator for Terminator Genesis. Of like a, you know, if you just saved that for the movie. Okay, that movie's been out for like four or five years
I haven't
now.
Seen
I'm
it.
Not gonna...
I didn't see it. I didn't
Jake,
know that.
It's in the. It's even in the trailer. It's in the trailer that...
Didn't watch any of the trailers. Thank you for ruining the Terminator like franchise. Thank you for ruining that for me.
I didn't realize you were such a big fan of the series. I'm very sorry.
Isn't the next Terminator ignoring that one in the continuity? Aren't they just like pretending like it didn't happen?
Yeah.
Yeah. And Sarah Connor is in it. So...
Why not?
But... Not Emilia Clarke's Sarah Connor, but I'm so confused.
But Linda Hamilton in CGI younger face.
Yes, 100%. I think Shane Black has enough. He's in my good graces enough to where it's like I'll trust anything that he does. His past couple movies have been pretty great. I mean, the three movies he's directed, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, Iron Man 3, and The Nice Guys, are all pretty great films. So I trust him. I think the cast has me a little bit worried. There's just some pieces that feel off, which is weird because all these actors are great actors in their own right. Trevante Rhodes, Boyd Holbrook, Olivia Munn.
Can we put Olivia Munn in the great actor category?
Have you watched Newsroom? Okay,
I was about to say, have you watched Newsroom?
I've not. So I will.
She's fantastic. She is one of the best parts of Newsroom.
Yeah.
You should watch Newsroom. It's only like 25 episodes.
Olivia Munn, I apologize.
Yeah, but each episode's like an hour.
On behalf of myself and me, I apologize for my ignorance.
On behalf of the power of the free world.
Yes, I apologize for assuming. But I will,
Trevor,
just
let's get on an official press release tweet for Jake's apology just before the... let's get it to the presses before they can make the story
okay,
their own.
Yeah, we
need to stay out in front of this.
Yeah. Exactly.
I think my longest exposure to her in a film was X-Men Apocalypse. So,
great choice. Yeah. No, that would be the one that I would say to avoid if you want to stay a fan of Olivia Munn, because that one's not good. But I feel like part of that is Bryan Singer.
Absolutely.
So, just to be fair. I mean, he also put Oscar Isaac in a Power Rangers villain costume.
Dr. Ooze, man.
And had him...
Ivan Ooze, that's who it was, not Dr. Ooze.
Ivan Ooze.
Yeah, so I just, out of all the things, out of all the choices, I think Olivia Munn's one of the more forgivable.
All right, I get it. I was wrong.
Movie.
It's fine.
Right,
let's
move on.
We've
spent too much time on Olivia Munn.
We spent too much time. We're going to get to a new segment that we have before we just keep rambling. And it's a segment that Trevor came up with that I'm very excited about. It's called Movie Cast Mad Libs. And how this is going to work is I'm going to give Jake and Trevor a description of a character. They're going to give me a modern actor who they feel like could play that role. And we're going to go through a whole cast. And then at the end of it, I will reveal what classic movie they have just recast for modern times. And then at that point, we'll, you know, go back over, okay, so this person is playing this role, this person's playing this role, more specifics of who they played. So let's start out easy. I'll give you guys just kind of an easy, softball, wide-open category. I'm looking to cast an older man with a charming voice who's slightly, you know, got a romantic feel to him.
Wait, like how old?
Let's say like grandfatherly old, like he could play your grandpa. Mm.
I like Jeffrey Rush for that kind of feel.
Okay.
Robert Redford.
So do we have to like
Jeffrey
agree,
Rush,
or are we gonna
no?
We just okay. We each give our own. Okay, that's fine.
Yeah, no. This way it'll be fun when we get to the end of which one maybe better represents that role.
Okay.
Okay. So the next one is I need a whiny. A child actor, probably like 8 to 13 year olds, who's very immature and just kind of doesn't know a lot about the world right now.
Well, I am always current on who's the hottest child actor, so.
I thought this one would be a tricky one, and so if you guys don't have anything, we can skip this and just put Jacob Tremblay. But I was curious if you guys
have Haley Joel Osment.
He's like 20.
He's older than we are, isn't he?
Yeah, I think he's older than
he
us.
He can play down. Elijah Wood.
I say Noah Schnapp.
Okay.
Is my pick.
Oh, yeah, the Stranger.
Oh.
Kids. I forgot they existed.
Yeah. Those are the only kid actors I know. And he could do whiny.
Then I'm going to go Schnapp. With the Finn Wolfhard. Because he is a whiner.
Okay.
In season 2, God, he sucked. Like his performance
right.
didn't suck, but his like the character he was playing sucked. He performed it so well. I'm sorry, Finn. Put it on the list. Olivia and Finn, this episode need an apology.
We're just gonna have a new apology letter sent out after every.
That's gonna
episode.
Be the credits.
We will tweet it directly after
them. Content of the
That's
week.
That's how we get viewership.
I'm just gonna go on an apology tour.
This is slowly turning into sports talk radio.
Oh God.
Sources called me, and Olivia Munn. Is going to L.A.
Oh, man.
Okay, next cast okay. member.
next cast. Okay, so this is the antagonist of the film. I need a male, 30-plus, kind of narcissistic, megalomaniac type.
I want to see Oscar Isaac play someone unlikable well.
Okay, that's a good choice. I like that. I will say, I feel like there's a very easy pick for this. Although he may not be 30 plus, so maybe not.
Oh,
you would say Miles Teller, wouldn't you, Cam?
I would say Miles Teller, yeah, for sure, 100%.
No, I hate Miles Teller. I would never cast him in anything. Even if it was like a film on Miles Teller's life, I'd be like, can we get Chris Pine in here to play Miles Teller?
Oh, man. Chris Pine's in a new limited series for TNT directed by Patty Jenkins. It's like a crime thriller thing. That looks fantastic.
Does it have to be 30s?
How much? Like,
come on, it's Hollywood.
Are you wanting to
we
go,
can be flexible.
Are you wanting to go older or younger?
A little older.
Okay, yeah, you can go a little older.
How old can I go?
Oh my gosh.
I would say try and keep it under like 50.
I'm gonna go Josh Brolin.
Mm, okay.
He played every villain this year, so.
Yeah, and he's also about to be in one other movie for Netflix called The Tale of a White Tailed Deer, I think,
oh,
or something
yeah,
like
that.
Oh, yeah,
that looks great.
So, Josh Brolin, having a big year. Okay, Brolin so sounds. I need a male who is a sidekick to the previously mentioned antagonist of the film. You guys, like, if you guys need more of a description, I can give you a little bit more.
Yeah, give me a little more.
So let's say that this is a guy who would be good at doing his own stunts. He's somebody who... you know, age, I wouldn't really be worried if you went a little older or a little younger. I think this role can be played by a ton of different people, but somebody that's good with their own stunts.
Tom Cruise, I called it.
Tom Cruise is nobody's sidekick.
But he did play a great cameo character in Tropic Thunder, so.
I'm going to say Armie Hammer.
Ooh, I like that. That's a
Trevor, I think you will look back on that choice with a lot of pride. All right, so I need a male. You could really play this role anywhere, 20 to 40. Someone with a real chip on their shoulder. Foreign, ambidextrous, and they have to be great at delivering one-liners.
They have to be ambidextrous?
Have to be ambidextrous.
You said foreign?
Taika Waititi.
Ooh!
Oh, I say Sebastian Stan.
Also a good choice.
Okay. Okay, male, larger than life, both physically and personality-wise.
The Rock. Dibs.
Man, our movie's expensive.
It's like The Expendables, but good.
Keegan-Michael Key doing his like, most over-the-top.
Like, in a bodysuit.
Yes, like, just...
A la just Vinnie Jones from X3.
Yeah, just doing too much.
Okay. Okay. Next up is a quick cameo character with a lot of comedic potential. A real miracle worker, you could say.
Real miracle worker.
Somebody who comes in, they just work miracles with that small little role that they're given.
Okay.
I mean, this is John Bernthal. It's all he does.
Ooh. Oh my gosh. Oh, that's so good.
Can be anybody.
Anybody. Male, female, doesn't matter. Comedic.
And comedic. Bill Hader.
Ooh, I like that as well. That's a great one. All right. Now let's cast the female lead. 20 to 29, whiny at times, but very courageous and strong-willed. She's gotta have some range.
Saoirse Ronan.
That's a good one. I'm going to go Tessa Thompson.
Oh, yeah.
Ooh.
She's great.
Okay. Now let's cast the male lead. Male.
How big
late
is
20s.
This movie? There's a lot of people going on.
It's pretty big. Male lead. Late 20s, early 30s. A real Prince Charming type. He's got to be persistent to a fault where he, you know, maybe masks his emotions and a little bit of a people pleaser.
20 to 29.
A real people pleaser.
Real peeper peepers.
Real peeper peepers.
Aziz Ansari.
Oh. Wow.
Nice. Oh my gosh, I'm so in on this movie. This is incredible.
Man. I'm going to go Alden Ehrenreich.
Oh, ooh.
Yeah. He's very likable.
Yeah, he's got the charm.
All righty. Last role that you guys are casting, and I think this will give away what movie we are casting. Right as I say this, a voice that will sit with you for weeks after. This person has to be an inconceivable talent.
Oh, goodness.
Oh, my God.
Oh, this is going to be
this person,
so good.
If they hate rhyming, it's a bonus.
Vin Diesel.
Oh, dang.
Oh, my God.
Man, the first person that came to my mind was Kevin Spacey, but we're not going to put him in my movie.
Yeah. Okay. What about Kevin James?
Kevin James.
Just anyone named Kevin. No, I want Val Kilmer in this role.
Ooh.
Okay, so.
Alrighty.
My Vin Diesel was a joke.
Oh, dang it.
I'm sorry. I'm going to go Kate McKinnon.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Great choice.
All right.
Well, congratulations, Trevor and Jake. You guys have just cast a modern version of The Princess Bride. So, Trevor, let's run through your cast first, then. As Peter Falk, the grandpa / narrator, Trevor, you cast Jeffrey Rush. For Fred Savage, the grandson, you cast Noah Schnapp, who is Will Byers from Stranger Things. As Chris Sarandon, a.k.a. Prince Humperdinck, you cast Oscar Isaac, the villain. Nice. Mm. I like that pick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Christopher Guest, a.k.a. Count Tyrone Rugen, Army Hammer, a.k.a. the Six-Fingered Man.
Oh, yeah.
Mandy Patinkin, a.k.a. Inigo Montoya. You cast Sebastian Stan.
Great.
Oh, yes. That'd be so good.
For Andre the Giant, a.k.a. Fezzik, you cast Keegan-Michael Key. as Billy Crystal, aka Miracle Max, you cast John Bernthal.
Okay, that would amazing.
For Robin Wright, who plays Buttercup, you cast Saoirse Ronan. For Carrie Ewells, who plays Wesley, aka the Dread Pirate Roberts, you cast Aziz Ansari. And last but not least, as the great Wallace Shawn in his famous role of Vizzini, you cast Val Kilmer.
Nice. Man.
So, all right. I think this movie should never be remade, but I would watch it with those people.
I would definitely watch it. I think that's a pretty great cast. Let's go through Jake's now. Jake as Peter Falk, the grandpa, you cast Robert Redford. Wise choice. Mm-hmm. As the grandson, you cast Finn Wolfhard. As Prince Humperdinck, you cast Josh Brolin, mm-hmm. which is...
That would be...
I think that's a pretty good pick.
Pretty intense.
As intense. Yeah, as Count Tyrone Rugen, the six-fingered man, you cast Tom Cruise, which would just be so good. It would be so good. As Inigo Montoya, you cast Taika Waititi.
Yes.
Yes, that would be great.
As Fezzik, you cast Dwayne The Rock Johnson, which is a great, great choice.
It's like your only option.
The only other acceptable choice would have been John Cena. As Miracle Max, played by Billy Crystal, you cast Bill Hader, which is so spot on.
Okay.
Princess Buttercup, Jake, you have being played by Tessa Thompson.
Mm, yeah. All right.
And as the Dread Pirate Roberts, you have Alden Ehrenreich. And as the famous Vizzini, you have Kate McKinnon.
Okay.
Alden, I would see both Alden of Ehrenreich those. Could nail the whole Dread Pirate Roberts bit, I think.
Agreed.
Yeah. I think the best choice in Jake's cast is Tom Cruise as the six-fingered man.
See, this is one of those things that would like never, ever happen, but would be so amazing.
Yeah.
Honestly, it would be both like, of those casts are like really good.
Yeah,
I
agree.
Whoever
yeah.
remakes this, give us a call.
Love Trevor's choice of John Bernthal as Miracle Max. That's yeah. something I would see so quick.
So that would be so weird.
John Bernthal being like, he said to bluff, which obviously means you were playing cards.
I can't even like imagine that.
It'd be so good.
Also,
it would
be let's
so
be
good.
Real. Saoirse Ronan is way too good for this movie.
Absolutely.
I think Tessa Thompson is too, if I'm being 100% honest.
Yeah. Robin Wright in this movie is not good. I don't understand why people were like, Robin Wright's amazing. It's like, well, she doesn't do anything.
No.
Yeah. There's I think you guys did a pretty fantastic job. I will say to the audience, they did not know anything about who was playing or like any of the character descriptions beforehand. They did this off the top of their head. So round of applause for Jake and Trevor for their amazing cast for The Princess Bride.
I do want to warn everyone that anytime we get one of these and it says quick person for a cameo just for 5 minutes, I'm always going to say John Bernthal.
That's his go-to role. And, which is funny and fitting because we're going to be talking about Sicario, and which in the original, he had a quick 5 minute role.
That's right.
Okay. So this week we reviewed the sequel to the 2015 film Sicario by reviewing the new film Sicario Day of the Soldado. So I have a feeling we all, or me and Trevor, have very similar feelings on the original Sicario directed by Denis Villeneuve and starring Emily Blunt with cinematography by Roger Deakins. Trevor, can we both just agree that it's a masterpiece of filmmaking?
I mean, yeah, I think that if we were to, all three of us, come up with our collective favorite director, it would probably be Denis Villeneuve, yeah. Who's just maybe the best working right now. Or on his best game anyway. I saw the first Sicario for the first time a couple weeks ago, and it has stuck with me. It's beautiful. It's haunting. It's a picture of humanity and reality that really brings you in. And it's well acted, it's well directed, it's well shot. It is a masterpiece. I agree.
There is some, like, I really do think it's one of Deakin's best jobs as a cinematographer. There are some shots in there, like the soldiers descending into the tunnel at dusk, which is just absolutely incredible.
Something great about that film is that it feels like almost every shot is like the widest it could have possibly been for what they wanted to shoot. And I love that because it makes it makes all the characters seem so insignificant in the world around them. And it fits the feel of the movie so well.
The other thing that Sicario has is a script by somebody that we've all been pretty huge fans of for the past couple of years.
Yeah.
Taylor Sheridan, who was an actor, and then he wrote Sicario. He wrote Hell or High Water. Then he wrote and directed Wind River, which came out last year and was the favorite movie of the podcast from last year. So I think we're all pretty high on Taylor Sheridan. And getting into our general thoughts, that's, you know, going into this, there's a new director, there's a new cinematographer. Emily Blunt's not in it, but Josh Brolin's still in it. Benicio del Toro's still in it, and it's still written by Taylor Sheridan. So I had some hope, but I did not like this movie whatsoever.
Yeah, it's a fine movie, I guess, but I'm not sure what it was supposed to be.
It feels like it's like two to four different movies, depending on how you want to look at this. There's the Josh Brolin plot. There's the Benicio del Toro and Isabella, what's her last name? Isabella Moner plot. Then there's the cartel plot. And then there's the Miguel border plot. Like, there's different things going on that all feel slapped together, that none of them really work collectively. And there are parts of this that very much feel like, I think we're trying to be a commentary on where we are politically, but end up coming out as like a,
it's like,
I'm trying to figure out how to phrase this
almost.
Yeah. Like a fear mongering, like somebody who wants to put a wall up. It feels like they're like wet dream.
Yeah.
Of this is like exact, like you would show like the first 10 minutes of this movie to somebody who was on the border about, well, that's not exactly the pun I probably should have made, on the board about whether or not to build a wall.
Right.
You know, that opening scene is just so hard to digest because I feel like it doesn't add anything to the movie, but it just kind of is meant to completely shock you out of your element without any real effect on the rest of the movie. Like,
yeah.
The movie's the exact same without that.
Yeah, I agree. I guess without getting into too specific things right now, my worry is now that Taylor Sheridan has told all of the good stories that he has to tell. And I don't want to get to that. I don't want to say that for sure because it's the first thing we've seen from him that just wasn't flat out great.
Right. But my other worry, just to quickly go off of that, is his TV show that he just is an EP on and he wrote and directed on, Yellowstone, starring Kevin Costner, has not been getting good reviews at all.
Yeah, I saw that.
So, is there a little bit of a worry? Did he only have like three? Which, if all he had was three great scripts in him, great career. Those three scripts are amazing. Like, those three scripts are better than anything that we could ever hope to do writing-wise. So, job well done. But as far as like being, you know, critical of the job, you know, I don't know. It's weird.
The big issue for me is that this didn't feel natural. Like, all of his other movies feel so authentic, like with real people making real decisions and encountering a real world. And this did not feel that way.
Well, I feel like part of that comes from the fact that, at least I was trying to look back and trying to remember, it's been close to 2 years, I think, since I saw Hell or High Water. I watched Wind River probably a couple months ago, and I watched Sicario last week. I think this is the first time that he has almost like this Christopher Nolan-esque like side of trying to meld all these different plots together. And the other ones are all pretty like, there's one plot. There's maybe like a little side plot here or there, but it's all pretty like narratively straight. Mm-hmm. And I think this has a couple tree branches that don't ever come back and are just kind of like, or maybe they're, I mean, I guess the better phrase would be that they're river deltas that never feed into the same body of the ocean. They all just go different places, but then it's like you try and build a man-made canal and it's like, well, that's not how things naturally work. It's it's frustrating. It really was, like, to have this guy who's been one of the best writers over the past 3 years all of a sudden put this out. And it's, I mean, this feels as if somebody's like, you were to hire me to be like, hey, I want you to write a Taylor Sheridan-esque script.
Yeah, it didn't even seem like, it seemed like one of those, like, that we see all the time, sequels that were like a completely different crew than before.
Right.
And writing, directing, everything. It didn't feel like it had the continuity of the story.
Right.
And I know it's not really a sequel. It's more of like a spinoff or a different kind of thing with the same characters, but it still didn't feel right.
Yeah, something felt off the entire time. And, you know, you're missing arguably the three biggest pieces from the first film. You're missing Denis Villeneuve, who directed Sicario, he directed Prisoners, he directed Arrival, and he directed Blade Runner 2049. He's arguably the best worker, or the best director working today. Roger Deakins, who without argument is the best cinematographer working today. You could maybe argue that Chivo is pretty close. And then Emily Blunt, who's one of the best actresses. So you're missing three pretty critical parts from that original team that made that movie work so well. And it's just, it feels so disjointed without those three in it. And I think without Deakin's beautiful cinematography, without Denis' very masterful directing, and without Emily Blunt's character, who was such a moral compass and a representation of the audience in that first film, this movie just falls flat on its face.
That's like, exactly what I was going to say. Without Emily Blunt's Kate, you don't have the... There's not the skepticism or someone questioning why we're doing what we're doing.
Right. And I feel like they try and put Benicio del Toro and Josh Brolin in that role.
Right.
And Isabella Reyes.
The problem is that none of the characters in this movie are really likable.
No. Oh gosh. The most likable character is Isabella Reyes, played by Isabella Moner. And she's likable, but they don't give her anything to do. She is very much a damsel in distress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's not even like the moment where, I mean, there's like a little bit of like a moment with her and Benicio del Toro of some conversations, which is actually the best part. But we'll get into spoilers when we talk about that. But it's so many different pieces that come together and don't work whatsoever. And it's weird to have a writer who has shown his prowess and his master over the art just put this out. Maybe this was something where he was offered a lot of money to be like, hey, we want you to write a sequel. And he's like, okay, sure. And wrote it on a timeline that he wasn't comfortable with. But this just doesn't feel up to the caliber of films that Taylor Sheridan has written so far. Not by a long shot. So let's get into spoilers for this movie. So starting out on a positive note, the best part of this movie is the scene where Benicio del Toro's Alejandro Gillick and Elizabeth Moner's Isabella Reyes come to find a man near the border who's deaf with his family. And that is the best part of the whole movie. That interaction was like classic Western. It gave you heart to Benicio del Toro's character. It gave you understanding to him that contrasted what we had known about him. And I mean, that was the best part of the movie for me.
Did you think that it was a little bit too easy that he knew sign language?
I feel like normally that would be the case, but I think like the added backstory of like his daughter was deaf was a pretty like, at least for me, like it worked as far as it was as smooth as it could have been. I'm not saying that it was completely smooth, but it, once you like got that part, I almost wish that like that had happened earlier, that revelation of like he knew it because of that. Because once you got over that, it was just kind of a delight to watch this like beautiful chemistry between these characters on screen.
Yeah, it was a sweet moment. It was a nice kind of break from everything else. I was in the back of my mind worried that he was going to kill that whole family when they left.
Oh my gosh. And that's the weird thing is like, so if you watch Sicario, we leave, which, okay, spoiler for Sicario, if you haven't seen that film, we leave that film. The last thing we see of Benicio Del Toro's character is him holding, what's her name? Emily Blunt's character at gunpoint, asking her to sign something. And before that is him executing two kids and a mom, and then in front of the dad before he executes the dad. Like, he's not necessarily a sympathetic character. And so that was the weird part of, like, going from that to this. It almost, like, if this was a prequel, that would make more sense. Like, the ending of this movie had turned him fully into a hardened criminal instead of, like, ending from where we were there to here.
I think the biggest problem for me in this film is that it sort of treats Alejandro as, like, the main character and the protagonist. And he's, at least in my mind, not really someone worthy of being that type of character. I think his character works much more as a kind of a side or secondary character who, like, does what needs to be done or whatever. And also, it was kind of a weird retcon thing where we thought he killed the person responsible for his family's deaths, but no, it turned out this other guy was actually just as or even more responsible. So he wanted to kill him just as much. And so that was kind of a weird thing.
Which is weird when you consider what he did to that guy's family, but then when he has the chance to kill this guy's family, he doesn't take it. Which I guess, yeah, could be a lesson in getting to know somebody and what that does for murderers. Oh, that's weird. But it's just such a contrast to who that character was the first time Benicio Del Toro played it. And that's not to say that Benicio Del Toro does a bad job, because he is by far one of the best parts of this movie, if not the best part. The other best part being Elizabeth Moner. She's fantastic. Josh Brolin's great. The cast is good, but it's, other than that, nothing else really works. So do you feel like the marketing of this movie was very different than the movie that we actually got?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I don't remember a ton of the trailer. It did seem to focus much more on the really violent aspects of the film.
Right.
It kind of just, the trailer made it seem like it was Matt Graver and Alejandro just like hunting down all of the bad guys and killing them in the middle of the street.
Right.
Which didn't,
like, it was just going to be like the end scene of Sicario over and over.
Right.
Again.
Right.
In my eyes, I'm going, wow, that crazy thing that Benicio Del Toro does with the gun is in the trailer. What kind of crazy things do they have that aren't in the trailer? And really there wasn't.
That was a very weird anything. Thing. That didn't fit his character. He's very efficient.
Well, that was pretty efficient. I mean, if you're looking for a way to get a lot of shots out of a gun that's not an automatic, I think that's a pretty efficient way to do it. Okay. If anybody has ever actually done that in real life, probably not. But next time I step out on the paintball field, I will be looking to pull the Benicio Del Toro. So let's, there's kind of two more things to talk about, or a couple more things to talk about. We kind of touched on the opening bombing scene. That's such a problematic scene for me. It's just such a, like, plays into the fears. Like, that's the ultimate fear of so many people that it feels like such a cheap way to get from point A to point B.
And also, it has, the rest of the story has, like, I guess it's sort of why the whole thing starts happening, but that's not really made clear as to why this strategy is going to help with the influx of terrorism, of terrorists. Right. But, and it's almost,
and even,
like,
towards the end of the movie, they say that like three out of those four bombers were American citizens.
Right. It's almost like an,
and so it doesn't even matter.
It's like an excuse to remind you that there are, it's like an excuse to remind you or say that there are Arab people that want to kill you and you should be scared of them.
Right.
It's very weird.
I have, like, at least, and this is a personal thing with movies. Like, I want to go to a movie and I want to walk away having learned something that to, like, better myself, seeing a side of humanity that I haven't seen before, or just having a good time. Like, I go to a movie for an escape to have a good time. And this was the exact opposite. Like, I walked out of this just, it's one of those things like you walk out of and you're like on edge of every single person around you, even though like you've never said a word to them. They've never like, it's just a terrible way to walk out of a movie of like, be fearful of everyone around you. When you walk into the grocery store, be suspect of everyone around you. It's like Alex Jones probably watched this and was like, oh my gosh, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen.
Yeah, for real.
But it's just, it's such a cheap way to get from point A to point B.
Yeah. Unnecessary. And just,
yeah, 100%. And then, so from there, we, you know, we get some other details, and then we kind of just cut to this scene with a character named Miguel, and this side plot that Miguel, who starts out, he's introduced as somebody who's just trying to get his siblings on the bus to school, and he's at a bus stop, and then he doesn't get on the bus, and then he's at the border with his cousin drinking, smoking, and then from there he's like offered a job, and then you learn that the job is that he is getting people across the border. Because he knows both sides of it. And this felt like I was, the whole time I was waiting for how this would play into the movie. And when you get the end result of he was across the border in the United States, or I guess in his hometown, and he recognized, or he sees Benicio del Toro. And then at the end of the movie, when Benicio del Toro and Isabella Moner's characters are trying to get across the border, he recognizes Benicio del Toro. And that's where things go awry, is that they then hold Benicio del Toro at gunpoint because this kid recognized him. Did that like reveal or side plot matter to you whatsoever?
Yeah. So it was kind of a compelling story a little bit. Everything escalated a little bit quickly. I think it was an interesting look at what it's like for that, like what it's like in that culture and people who kind of have a little bit of a life on both sides. I think that's interesting. But like recognizing someone or being pretty sure you recognize someone from like last week is being a reason to like kill them is sort of bizarre to me.
Right.
I mean,
and also like, even if you did recognize him, how do you know? Like, it was weird to me that like he recognized him one, but that he was like, yeah, he's a bad guy, or like bad against our plot. Like, it's one thing to recognize somebody. It's another to be like, I know from that one look at him that he will cause us problems.
Right. Right. Yeah. Or even, I mean, like I try to think about myself in the situation. Like I definitely could not be sure enough that the person that I saw was the exact same person that I thought I saw a week ago.
Right.
Like if I didn't even meet them, but just saw them, like that's, it's a little, that whole part was a little thin to me.
Yeah. And then so from there, we've kind of set up the ending. Benicio del Toro's cover gets blown. Him and Isabel Reyes get taken into custody by this gang of people who are getting people across the border. And they're tied up, and Benicio del Toro is taken out to the middle of this pit. And the kid that identified him shoots him in the head. And you are led to believe that he's dead. Then within 5 minutes, it goes from pitch black darkness to daylight, which was completely weird. That was just a bad timing thing. You could have. It was just so weird that it was like, how far out are we? 5 minutes. And it's completely dark. And then it's like, how far are we? 2 minutes. Uh-huh. And then they were complete. It was completely light.
Yeah.
That was a little pet peeve. But then after a little bit, we are. Miguel jumps off the truck because he feels bad about, I guess, what happened. Brolin captures Isabella after just going nuts on these cars and killing everybody, and puts her into witness protection, which is a moment of like completely against the moral character that he's shown the entire movie.
Exactly.
And then Del Toro is alive, and it was revealed that he was just shot in the mouth and not actually killed.
Oh my gosh. So this movie would have been much more interesting if they just left that as it was.
Like Benicio del Toro had died?
Yeah, that he's just dead. This random, that he like met his ending by this random kid in the middle of the desert.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe. That part of the movie definitely feels... It's very Revenant-esque. And I think what works in The Revenant is that scene. Like, that scene works very well, but here it just kind of works as like a... Because it's at the end of the movie, it's like, okay, he's alive, what's the next step? But they take, like, literally, I think, like, 10 or 15 minutes of him just figuring out, like, okay, I'm alive, I'm alone in the desert, how do I get from point A, like, how do I get back? Uh-huh. And it's just, like, this, like, slow waking up, him crashing into a fence pole, and then, like, being alive out of nowhere again, and then driving off. It's one of those scenes where, like, we want to have our cake and eat it, too.
Yeah.
None of it makes sense or works well within the context of the film.
Right.
And then at the end, Del Toro's, it flashes to 1 year forward. Miguel has tons of tattoos and is leading this life full time now. And then he goes back into the back of this diner where he gets his job from, and Benicio Del Toro is waiting for him and is like, so you want to be a Sicario? And closes the door, and it's like, does he murder him? Does he train him?
Yeah, so how does he even know where to find him? How does he know who shot him? I don't...
That's like the least questionable.
Right? But the
I
whole
think
thing
that
is
we've
like...
been like led to believe that like this character of Gillick has so many different talents that like he has a year to find somebody. I'm like, okay. Yeah.
Okay. Sure.
He can do
yeah.
that.
So
I'm more just like these cheesy tattoos on this character make no sense. You left a ambiguous ending in a terrible way, like not in like a fun Inception kind of way, but in a like, am I supposed to care what he does?
Right. It's
like,
yeah,
am I supposed to be
whole,
rooting for him to kill him?
The whole look of Miguel's character is like very stereotypical.
Right.
It's like, because what makes it even worse is that like the guys that he was hanging out with at that point didn't look like that. It's not like he was
no.
like joining like to try to fit in. Like his cousin didn't look like that.
No.
You know, it's just it felt very much like an outsider saying, well, this is what a troubled Mexican American youth might look like after he decides he's gonna go bad.
Right. Which is, you know, goes into this, I walk out of this going, what's this film? Like, what's the point of this movie?
It's about,
what are they trying to
it's
say?
It's about recruiting hitmen. New
Sicario. New Sicario. Which, apparently. I didn't know this until the end, but okay, so soldado means soldier. Uh-huh. And so it's Hitman, Day of the Soldier.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think that Sicario is a poor title for the first film.
Oh, I love Sicario as a title. I think that's a pretty great...
It's a cool-sounding word, but just being called Hitman for the film that it is doesn't make a lot of sense.
I think it does in, like, the end... Like, once you come to the end of the movie, it makes sense. But here, it's just a mouthful that doesn't fit the movie whatsoever. The action in this movie is pretty good. There's, like, some decent camera work. Like some of the scenes with the helicopter is fun. The 360 rotating camera in the Humvee during the assault scene is pretty good.
I'll say there's a lot of action in this film and I was never confused.
No.
So props on that, because that's something we don't talk about enough, about how action can be done poorly and very confusing.
Right. But I think we can both agree, this is a film that falls short very much so of the reputation of the first film.
Oh yeah, it's not even the same thing at all.
Yeah. So let's get to our final thoughts and ratings for Sicario: Day of the Soldado.
Man, for the first time, I like couldn't pull a number out of this thing for anything. Like I
was curious. I was like, are you going to give it a 1 out of 2?
That's the best that I can do. I give this movie like a C-.
Ooh.
D plus, maybe.
This movie has Trevor so upset that he doesn't even give it a number ranking.
I don't even know what to. I guess I'd give it a 1 out of 2.
Okay.
One, but it's just, it wasn't really that good to watch. It was, there were some interesting things here and there, and I will say it wasn't necessarily incredibly predictable, so there's that, but it just wasn't what we've come to expect from Taylor Sheridan from a story standpoint. It was fine, technically.
I feel like it was, like, predictable once you got, like, once you had the setup for the next scene,
right.
It was predictable where that would go.
Right, sure, sure.
Like, once you knew, like, okay, they're have a police escort on these back roads in Mexico. Okay, well, they're going to get assaulted.
Something okay. is going south here.
Right. Okay, Benicio del Toro is going to try and cross the border. Okay, now we know that, like, he's going to be recognized. He's going to, like, something's going to go terribly wrong here. Yeah, I think this movie's like a D for me. There's parts of it that are decent, but nothing works. It just feels like, it feels very much like the B team. And I hate saying this because there's a lot of very talented people working on this film, but it very much feels like the B team came in and made a direct to DVD version of Sicario.
Yeah. And they somehow got Del Toro and Brolin.
You know, I don't blame them for that because I think they both like probably have fun playing these roles. They're both great in these roles. And if this movie was just them two on screen doing the ending of the first Sicario, no, because even then you still don't have like the moral compass or like heart that you are provided. Like what made Benicio del Toro's character interesting in the first film is that he is the foil in every aspect to Emily Blunt's character. Like they are complete opposites in every way. And Emily Blunt's moral righteousness allows Benicio del Toro to go completely off in the other way.
Yeah.
So, alrighty. Well, that's all we have for our review of Sicario Day of the Soldado. Let's get to, wow, I said that in the most Texas way possible. Day of the Soldado.
Day of the Soldado.
I mean, what is a soldado anyways? Is that like a soldier or something? I don't know.
I mean, we got the wall. I don't know what the problem is.
Texas forever.
Texas forever. So let's go ahead and get to our content of the week, y'all.
Oh my gosh.
Trevor, what is your content of the week?
I've got two things. One, these are not new, but I've just really been jamming on the two albums from the British pop band Bastille. The first one is called Bad Blood. The second one is called Wild World. And this kind of thing is normally a little too mainstream sounding for my elitist tastes, but these things are just so catchy and they're so fun, and I just like Bastille a lot, so check them out. And then also I've been watching Anthony Bourdain Parts Unknown on Netflix. I unfortunately had no idea how cool of a dude he was until people were talking about him after he passed away recently. But yeah. Parts Unknown is great. It's just him going to different places everywhere and just sharing food with people, and it's just like, it's so full of life and so full of light, and in what just astounds me is how he's just not afraid of anything or anyone anywhere. He'll go anywhere, and he really shows that, you know, it's just a reminder that all people are the same. Like, we all get hungry, we all have needs. and I think it's a really good reminder of just life on this earth that we all share.
Jake, what is your content of the week?
Yeah, I mean, I've been crazy busy, so I haven't gotten a chance to watch too much stuff that's new, but got home last night, and we sat on the couch after a long weekend and saw that Star Wars The Last Jedi was on Netflix, and we rewatched it, and you know, I would just encourage everybody to, if you have seen it, if you haven't seen it, just watch it again, watch it for the first time, and just enjoy Star Wars. I definitely think that it is a film that needs multiple viewings to be appreciated, and I really enjoy it. I think it's a great film, a great addition to the series, and you can stream it now on Netflix for free, which probably won't happen much longer because Disney's streaming service is coming soon, I believe. So yes. Hop on that while you can.
I'm kind of in the same boat with Jake. Been a little bit busy lately, and in my free time have just been binging Brooklyn Nine-Nine, which I think we've recommended multiple times.
So good. Yep. We just finished it last week.
Yeah, it's great.
I just watched the fifth season for the first time, and there's some like genuine, like heartfelt, borderline Office heartfelt moments.
Also probably some of the best like laugh out loud comedic moments on television in a long time.
The moment when Andy Serkis has the lineup sing Backstreet Boys Tell Me Why is one of the better cold opens of a TV show.
Pretty great.
Andy Serkis or Andy Samberg?
Andy Serkis playing Andy Samberg via motion.
That's why it's so
good
great.
Save. Good
via
save.
via motion capture.
The other thing that I have to recommend is two of my favorite movies are celebrating anniversaries this past week. Baby Driver just hit 1 year, which is my favorite movie from 2017. So go check out Edgar Wright's masterpiece. And then last week, my favorite Pixar film of all time, WALL-E, celebrated its 10th anniversary. So go watch the amazing film WALL-E. If you've seen it already, go watch it again. If you haven't seen it, it is more than worth your time.
Hot take, best animated film of all time.
Ooh.
Hot take.
Save that for the hot take segment.
I'll put that in my pocket.
That's a scorcher. All righty, well, that's all we have for this week's episode. We'll be back next week with a new episode and a review of Ant-Man and the Wasp, the Marvel film that somehow ties into Infinity War but isn't Infinity War. I'm curious to see how this plays out. If you've enjoyed listening to us, please go to iTunes, subscribe, rate, review us, and go share us with your friends and family. That's the best way to just show us your appreciation, to connect with us, is just by sharing us and letting us know what you thought about the episode. Unless you hated it, which then don't share us. We forbid that. If you want to know more about us, you can go to our website at popcornoptional.com. If you want to connect with us, you can find us on Twitter at popcornoptional, or you can like us on Facebook at popcornoptional. My name is Cameron Salina. You can find me online at 321 Cami Time. Jake, where can we find you online?
You can find me at jakebrown.tv. Trevor?
I'm on Twitter and Instagram at TurboTrevor.
Until next time, we hope you guys have a great week. Watch some movies, and in the words of the great Michael Scott, we'll be back ASAP as possible.
Bye.
Y'all be good.